Hello and welcome to the Active Training Team podcast. This is part one of a special two-part podcast recorded in Scotland. It's presented by Director of ATT, Adam Christopher. Adam travelled to Scotland ahead of the opening of a new ATT Immersive Safety Training Centre for Scottish and Southern Energy, or SSE. We'll hear him take a tour of this new centre in Perth in part two of the podcast. In this first episode, Adam visits SSE's Pitlochry Dam and Visitor Centre to find out more about SSE's history of hydropower and safety training. At Pitlochry, Adam meets Gillian O'Reilly, SSE's Head of Heritage, who was keen to show Adam a view of the dam.
Okay, so here we are on the balcony of the visitor centre, and on our right-hand side as we look up the way, we're looking at Loch Faskally. This is the power station. This is the dam. The power station and dam were completed in 1950 and went into operation in 1951. That building across there with the lit window at the top was formerly the power station master's office, and is now where I work and where we have the corporate archive. And then across here, just as we look down the river here to our left, we're looking down at the fish ladder. And there are 34 pools that the fish swim up to get from the River Tummel down here up to Loch Faskally there.
So tell me why this was built and what the initial reaction to the plans of building it were by the local community?
Well, it wasn't a sort of taken on with open arms, that's for sure. I think the best place to start is with Churchill, okay? So we're middle of Second World War, and in Scotland in particular, there was a sort of surgence in the Central Belt where people were coming home and living in the Central Belt, which had been industrialised and which had the most jobs to offer. So Churchill, he approached Tom Johnston, who was a former Labour MP and was about to retire. He suggested to Johnston that he might want to be Secretary of State for Scotland. Johnston set up a council to look at what Scotland would look like post-war. And during that time, there was a huge amount of interest put on what would happen to the Highlands of Scotland. So basically, people coming back from war were not going to go back home to the Highlands because there was no work for them there. And that was going to create a massive clearance again of the Highlands of Scotland, and it was something that nobody wanted to see. There were two things that we could do: is industrialise the Highlands, and to do that we were going to have to get power up to the north of Scotland. But we could also tap into the natural resource, which allowed us to create jobs, and it felt like the right thing to do. So in 1943, the North of Scotland Hydroelectric Development Act was passed. It got resounding votes in favour, and the first hydropower station that came into being at that time was Sloy, and that's on the west coast of Scotland on the banks of Loch Lomond. When that went into construction, we started to look at Perthshire. So we already had Rannoch Power Station and Tummel Power Station at the top of this piece of water, if you like, in the Tummel scheme. And we knew it worked well. We knew that there was a lot of water here that we could tap into, and if we played our cards right, we could renew that water through several different power stations on the way. So we continued to develop hydro scheme here in Tummel, and that involves a number of power stations and dams. And this one that we're here at today, Pitlochry Power Station and Dam, is the last one in that cascade system. So Dalwhinnie, which is further up the A9, the road that you drove up this morning, Dalwhinnie is a distillery, you might know it, Dalwhinnie Whiskey. So the water that runs through the distillery comes out the other end, and it actually passes through five power stations before it comes down here. So it's dead cool. You know, way back in the 40s, we were creating renewable electricity from renewable sources. And yeah, so that's why Pitlochry is here. The foundation stone was laid in 1947. It started to generate power in October, November 1950, and it was officially opened in 1951.
Okay, so it's part of a chain of a whole infrastructure project, in part to provide power, but in part also to provide employment.
Yes.
For people.
So a lot going on.
There is a lot going on, and it's. I think many things haven't changed with regard to when they're planning infrastructure, of why it needs to be done, one for the community, one for the country, but also because it provides employment. So that's quite heartening to hear.
Yeah, the social and economic impact of the hydro schemes over the time has been phenomenal. And the people who worked on the schemes primarily were some local Scots people who were working directly in the schemes. These people were called tunnel tigers, and they had a really hard graft. So this was like, you know, people who are in with hand tools, a bit of gelignite, and they're blasting rock through to create tunnels. The majority of these people who worked on the schemes were from Ireland, in particular from Donegal. And having done oral history collection with them over the years, it's amazing the ripple effect that the hydro schemes had on Donegal. So basically, these people were coming across, they were staying in camps, they were working 12-hour shifts, sometimes doing double shifts, doing as much as they could. They were earning, you know, what we consider to be oil money now. You know, they were earning big money, and they were able to send it back home to an otherwise really impoverished Donegal at the time. So it made a massive impact. Lots of people that I've met, you know, have bought their own land. The houses that are standing on that land now came from hydro. But not to forget what was happening in Scotland here. So, you know, going back to things like the bed and breakfasts, whilst women weren't directly employed in the schemes, they were certainly getting an opportunity to benefit from the schemes. So lots of women were bringing food into the schemes, so into the camps. They were baking, they were selling their bacon, and they were opening up bed and breakfast and for engineers and workers that were travelling up and down through the different schemes. Whilst it was not popular, and really not popular, the locals were really opposed to it, and there was one hotel in Pitlochry that would house our engineers, and the shops wouldn't sell to our workers. This meant that one really sort of forward-thinking businessman in Perth actually drove up 3 times a week with his van full of cigarettes to sell cigarettes to the workers because they couldn't buy them here. So I think over the years that relationship has definitely changed. And I think we've become a big part of the community. I think we're a welcome part of the community. And I think the locals truly appreciate what the dam and power station has brought to the local community.
And how much care and consideration was given to the workforce? You've talked about people working with hand tools underground, dynamite. We wonder what there was no health and safety legislation at the time. What was the training that was provided for a lot of these guys?
So we know that very little training was given. Again, having spoken firsthand to the tunnel tigers in particular, they talk about being handed a bunnet, like basically a soft cap and a pair of welly boots. Sometimes those welly boots were passed between shifts. So they were sleeping in camps, they were sharing dorms, somebody came off a night shift, they wore the wellies. It was a difficult environment, and there is absolutely no doubt that health and safety has played a massive role in where we are as an organisation today. On saying that, whilst injuries weren't documented, we know that there were not a lot, you know, again from oral histories, but when they were, they tended to be fatalities. So it was when something horribly had gone wrong. But there was a really strong culture of looking out for each other. They worked in a pack. It was all about teamwork. You know, when the gelignite was blowing, they had their own routines that they adopted to shout how they would check, how it was going to happen, how they looked after each other. So I guess that's human nature as opposed to anything that was documented. And at the end of the day, if they didn't work, they didn't get money. So their survival and their well-being was of paramount importance to them.
And that's the message we still drive, huh?
Yeah.
It's ultimately who's responsible for your health and safety and well-being, who's responsible for the decisions you make, And what's the consequences for you if something bad happens? And it's around thinking personally the cost of this. Because of course there's the social and there's the moral, but there's also the business case argument, not just for the powers that be, the people at the top of an organization, but if you count yourself as a business, I get hurt, I can't work, I can't earn, I can't provide.
Correct.
And it's the same message that we're saying to the people that we come into contact with.
Yes.
We want to create that interdependent culture. From what you're saying, it's always been there where we look out for each other.
Definitely.
Because it makes sense.
Yep, definitely. Let me tell you a bit more about when we created the dam and the power station here. So, the River Tummel flows out of Loch Tummel, which is just a few miles up the road. And the river actually comes down through this piece of land up to the right here, and it still flows along the bed of this loch. So the river still comes down here. This piece of ground up here to the right was called Faskelly Estate, and I think something like a kind of 400-acre estate. So nice big estate, a lovely big stately home, Faskelly House. And I assume that through some form of compulsory purchase order, we were able to buy this piece of land. It was already a flat basin. There was a house and a farm here that are now underwater. And there was a playing field as well. So again, you know, compulsory purchase order, locals, you can imagine thinking maybe not the right thing and not very happy with us. But we flooded it to create a reservoir, and instead of calling it the Pitlochry's Reservoir, as we had named it in our plans and referred to it as we were building it, we put it out to local community and asked them if they would like to name it. And they came up with the name Loch Faskelly. And as part of the purchase, we had also taken ownership of Faskelly House. Now, I don't know what Faskelly House looked like in the early mid-1940s, but by 1950, we had created a training school. And the training school was really interesting. So whilst I talked about the Tunnel Tigers not getting much investment in terms of training and how to do the role, we certainly invested in the engineers who were going to be maintaining the assets as we built them. So what we know is that we were training groups of 20. Their training lasted for a year. We created a dorm. We had a badminton court. We had a cricket lawn. The trainees that came here regularly had the weekends off, so they went out hill climbing. We employed mainly, where it was possible, from the north of Scotland. Interestingly, we also employed people who had already undertaken some form of training. So they were either graduates or they had done national certificates, mainly, predominantly in electrical engineering, but some mechanical engineering. And mechanical engineering actually ramped up in the years to come. But predominantly in the early days, it was electrical engineering. When we advertised the roles, there was a huge swell of interest. When we interviewed, one of the questions was, are you married or engaged? Do you intend to be married? And if so, would the woman in your life settle in a job that was possibly quite remote and in the north of Scotland? So that was a real question. And actually, you can imagine, because this was going to be a hugely big cultural change for people, the people who came through that training programme were often set to be engineers in remote power stations. And if you were living at the top of a loch away in the middle of nowhere, and think 1940s and 1950s, train and public transport links wouldn't have been wonderful. Are you going to stay? Are you committed? And, well, isn't it wonderful that we considered whether, you know, If your wife is happy, you're going to be happy.
There's something funny in that, because I'm not sure how legal that question would be now today. But you can understand the business case argument of asking that question. But also it goes back to what we're talking about caring about folk.
Absolutely.
So one, you've got to care about the business. Of course you have. Because it's going to cost money if people come and do it and think, oh, wow, this is so remote, I can't live here. Or their partner was causing marital stress.
Sure.
So actually, it's a question that demonstrates you care, obviously, about the business, but obviously about that person, because you want the right people to come.
You're investing in the people.
Yeah.
You know, and we care. Yeah, absolutely.
Care being the operative word, isn't it? And that I always think is a sign of what we talk about as good, effective leadership, what that looks like and how that makes people feel.
Yeah.
And if you have care coursing through your veins, then I think that will reap reward for everybody. So tell me a little bit more about your input into the naming of the training centre that ATT are involved with.
So we ran a competition at work to come up with names, and actually I thought some of the names were really quite good. I thought there was some really inspired names that had been put forward. However, because I live in archive world and I'm always thinking about the past and, you know, building on the past to create a better future, it's easy for me to draw on what we've done before. And something just struck me, and I thought the culture at that time at Faskelly Training House in the 1940s and 1950s was to take people and give them a future where they had a control and understanding of their own safety and their own well-being. And that was paramount. And it just felt to me like our culture hasn't changed. Safety is still that, you know, still front of mind. We still care hugely that people get home at the end of every day. So you come to work, you do a safe job throughout the day, and you get home to your family at night. It just, something really clicked with me. And I thought, you know, it's just that legacy, it's just that passing down through the generations, and just a nod to the past, basically. That's what it was, a nod to the past. We did it well before, and, you know, if we can drive the same successes from what we did 60, 70, 80 years ago, then I think we're on a path to do wonderful things.
Thank you so much, Gillian, for your hospitality here in Penlochry. It's fantastic. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Please come back and, have a good, safe journey back down to Perth.
In part two of this Active Training Team podcast, we'll hear from Adam as he takes a tour of the brand new SSE Faskelly Safety Leadership Centre in Perth. He'll go behind the scenes to see some of the preparations ahead of the centre's opening.
We're about a week out from our first delivery day, first performance. So everyone's just working really hard to get the lines under their belt, to get to grips with the technology, things like iPads, and just the space in general, because it's rather big, lots of different rooms and lots of corridors.
Thanks to Gillian O'Reilly for her time, and to all the staff at the Pitt Lochry Dam and Visitor Centre for their welcome. The podcast is presented by Adam Christopher and produced by Alexandra Quinn for Loftus Media. You can find more information about Active Training Team at activetrainingteam.co.uk.